Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Library of Virginia. I'm Sandy Treadway, the director of the library, and on behalf of all of us here at the library, it's wonderful to see you all tonight for this event in a series of Poetic Principle events that the library has been hosting in partnership with Blackbird, the online journal of literature and the arts that are produced by VCU's Department of English and New Virginia Review. Tonight's event and reception are funded in part by the Carol M. Weinstein Virginia Authors Fund, which supports programming relating to a wide variety of Virginia writers here at the library, especially poetry and poets. This is the first in a series of events highlighting the work of Virginia authors that's part of an almost week-long Virginia Literary Festival that's going to be held here in Richmond, in which the library has partnered with a wide array of folks and organizations from across the community, from the James River Writers to the University of Richmond Downtown to the Byrd Theater, the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts, Richmond Public Library, the Poe Museum, and many, many others. When you came in this evening, you should have been given a program, and if you weren't, please make sure to get one at the conclusion of the program, because there's a list of all the week's events, and we hope you'll find some other events that are of interest and that we'll see you again later in the week. We're really pleased to kick off the festival with tonight's event, celebrating the Commonwealth's vibrant poetry scene. And here to tell you more about this evening's wonderful poets and to introduce them to you is Mary Flynn, the senior editor of Blackbird and the director of the New Virginia Review.
And I'm going to get out of the way very quickly. So thank you to the Library of Virginia. Thank you to the Carol Weinstein Fund and to Carol herself for caring about poets. It's always good for somebody to care about poets. My co-senior editor at Blackbird is Greg Donovan, who's here too. So it is our great pleasure to publish a fair bit of poetry as well as fiction and other writing, and we have been lucky enough to publish both Ellen and Charles and to know them for a long time. Getting longer and sort of scarier. But tonight, Ellen will be introduced by Claudia Emerson, and Ellen will read first. Claudia Emerson is a distinguished poet who's just made Richmond her home. And then another distinguished poet, David Wojahn, after Ellen's reading, will introduce Charles. And just look at how many wonderful poets are in Richmond. They're just all over the place, plus artists. But anyway, so Claudia.
Thank you. Thanks also to the Library of Virginia, everyone for coming out, Sandy Treadway, Carol Weinstein, Mary Flynn, you always do a good job organizing these events. I really am honored to be here, and particularly honored this evening to be able to introduce Ellen Bryant Voigt. I hope you'll forgive me for taking a quick minute to tell you that Ellen and I are from the same small town of Chatham, Virginia, a place of about 1,000 people in what we call Southside. Her mother, in fact, was my fourth grade teacher. Zoo Bryant was a strict teacher and a wonderful one, and she often took a few minutes in the morning announcement period to brag about her children. And Ellen, I remember, she praised most often for being her musician. So when I began writing poetry and considering graduate school, I was still living in Chatham. Ellen was long gone, living and writing in Vermont, where she still lives and writes. I was working for the post office as a rural letter carrier, where Ellen's father had been a letter carrier as well. So it seemed to me a fine idea to write to Ellen. And I know now, and I apologize publicly, I know how inappropriate, presumptuous, and small town minded it was of me to ask for her advice, and even worse, to send her a bunch of my poems for her opinion. But she wrote back. She commented on the poems. She approved of my plan to apply to the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. But she wrote that if that didn't work out, she would recommend VCU. And now here we are all these years later. But regardless of my personal connection, I know I'm not alone in benefiting from Ellen's wisdom. She has shepherded countless of us poets. And I'm also not alone in my opinion that Ellen Bryant Voigt is one of the most brilliant poets writing today. Her career long now, increasingly rich, and more important than ever. She has written several critically acclaimed and celebrated volumes of poetry. Her honors, awards, and professional accomplishments, so numerous, I'll quickly highlight only a few. She was awarded the O.B. Hardison Poetry Prize. She was a finalist for the National Book Award, the National Book Critics Circle Award. She is a recipient of fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Guggenheim Foundation, and the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund. In all her spare time, she served as Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets, and she began the country's first low-residency MFA program at Goddard College, something now emulated across the nation, and she still teaches for the Warren Wilson MFA program. Her most recent book of poems, Headwaters, has just arrived. It is so new, in fact, I believe we might be one of the first audiences since its publication. And in addition to her books of poetry, she has published volumes of essays on craft, lauded by Edward Hirsch as, quote, one of the most acute poetic thinkers. And as a matter of fact, students in the spring poetry workshop at VCU will begin their new semester with Ellen's brilliant volume, The Art of Syntax. No matter where her creative or scholarly attention takes her, Ellen follows her genius, never succumbing to poetic or literary or theoretical fashion, even as she is cognizant of it. In short, each of her books is a masterpiece, distinctly hers, and each utterly distinct. In everything she does, then, Ellen Bryant Voigt is the exemplar, and as such, she models, she challenges, she teaches, and she also gives permission to believe that poetry can matter, that beauty and meaning must. As a younger poet, I, along with countless other fledgling poets before and since, learned from Ellen that in writing about the place where we came into consciousness, that place William Faulkner called the postage stamp of native soil, we might actually move far beyond any sort of ordinary aboutedness. To follow Ellen's example is to find that poetry can offer a way out of a place, or a time, in memory, or in history, and then to see that the artistic exodus is also an entrance, a finer return with a wider understanding. Ellen's first book, Claiming Kin, one of the first books of poems I ever owned, contains a poem called The Hen, and an ordinary scene in the rural South of a chicken being beheaded and a child's perception of the headless body as it, quote, flapped the insufficient wings and staggered forward, convulsed, instinctive. And then the child's sudden understanding that, quote, it was this that held life and gave life and not the head with its hard, contemplative eye, end quote. I can still feel the original awe I had at the poem itself, and also at my new understanding that this was what poetry was capable of, such violence and then such absolute beauty. Ever since then, I have leaned in close. Ellen, we are all eager to hear you read this evening. Please join me in welcoming Ellen Bryant Voigt.
Well, that was exceedingly generous. Yeah, Claudia also played my flute. She didn't tell you that part. She started band and needed a flute. I'm very proud of her. I'm going to read just from this new book. I'll start with the title poem, which is called Headwaters. You can hear all the way back just fine? Okay, let me know if not. I made a large mistake. I left my house. I went into the world. It was not the most perilous, hostile part, but I couldn't tell among the people there who needed what. No tracks in the snow, no boot pointed toward me or away. No snow as in my dooryard, only the many currents of self-doubt. I clung to my own life raft. I had room on it for only me. You're not surprised. It grew smaller and smaller, or maybe I grew larger and heavier. But don't you think I'm doing better in this regard? I try to do better. As Claudia told you, I've lived in Vermont a long time, been there since 1969. So this is a very much a Vermont poem called Roof. After a week of daily heavy snow, I want to praise my roof first, the acute angle at which it descends from the ridgepole, and second, that it is black, the color absorbing all the other colors, so that even now, as Arctic air blows in from the plains, my roof burns off from underneath the dazzling snow, dense layers of particles, which are tiny specks of trash sheathed in wet cloud. What chance do they have against my roof? Even at night, the snowpack over my head breaks apart and slides on its own, melting down from the eaves as though my roof had shrugged. I hear snow thump to the ground, a cleansing sound. The secret of my roof is standing seams, the raised ridges bonding the separate panels to one another, an old wound that has healed, no lapped shingles catching the wind, no ice jam at the eaves, no sending my beloved out with an axe, no roof caved in from the weight of snow as happened in 1924, only another thump as a slab of snow lets loose, leaving my roof gleaming in the wet residue. It takes what it needs from the life source and sheds the rest. A useful example if I were starting over. This one is called Moles. Where is his hat? Where is his horse? Where is his harrier? My beloved is distraught. He made this yard, each blade, each stem, each stalk, except the mounds of fresh dirt like little graves. It's moles that make the mounds. When they make holes, they're worms with fur. The cat does not do moles. She's stalking rooks and mice. Beloved has scattered human hair across the sod. It keeps the deer away. He has installed a high-pitched hum in the lily bed. It keeps the dogs out of the yard who might have otherwise unearthed a mole. Too bad. Traps don't work the way they do for squirrels. My father used to thrust the hose into one hole and flood them out. My beloved does not care what my father did. This greensward is his joy, his job. My job was children, food, house. The rest of what I did stayed underground. If you have any good solutions for moles, please pass them along to me. Groundhog. Not unlike otters, which we love, frolicking, floating on their backs like truant boys unwrapping lunch. Same sleek brown pelt, some overtones of gray and rust. Though groundhogs have no swimming hole, and lunch is rooted in the ground beneath short legs, small feet, like a fat man's odd diminutive loafers. Not frolicking, but scurrying layers of fat. His coat gleams as though wet, shines chestnut, sable, darker head and muzzle lower into the grass, a dark triangular face like the hog-nosed skunk, another delicate nose and not a snout. Doesn't it matter what they're called? I like swine, which are smart and prefer to be clean, using their snouts to push their excrement to the side of the pen. But they have hairy skin, not fur. His fur shimmers and ripples. He never uproots the mother plant. His teeth, I think, are blunt, squared off like a sheep's. If cornered, does he cower like sheep or bite like a sow with a litter? Is he ever attacked? He looks to me inedible. He shares his acreage with moles, voles, ravenous crows. Someone thought up the names. His other name is Botched Algonquin, but yes, he burrows beneath the barn where farmer once dried cordwood. He scuttles there at speech, cough, laugh, at lawnmower, swollen brook, high wind. He lifts his head as Gandhi did, small, tilt to the side, or stands erect like a prairie dog or a circus dog. But dogs don't waddle like Mao with a tiny tail. He seems asexual like Gandhi, like Jesus. If Jesus came back, would he be vegetarian, also pinko, freako, homo? In Vermont, natives scornful of greyhounds from the city self-appoint themselves woodchucks, unkempt, hairy, macho, who would shoot on sight an actual fatso, shy, mild marmot, radiant as the hog-nosed skunk in the squirrel trap, both cleaner than sheep, fur fluffy like a girl's. Maybe he is a she. It matters what we're called. Words shape the thought. Don't say rodent and ruin everything. Noble dog. Behind our house, down to the brook in the woods, beyond the groomed grass and flower beds, what we see are brook and woods and sometimes mild creatures of the field. We thought when we bathed in the claw-footed tub, we could pretend we stayed inside the natural world. No shutters, no shades at night. Beside the mirror over the sink, the windows darkened into mirrors, where my daughter at 13 admired her tan, her new body, until she felt or thought she felt something move outside in the yard and asked quietly up the back stairs for us to come down here for just a minute, please. Come down here now. We couldn't tell how much was fear, how much was shame. We thought she needed us to be calm. We tried to be calm, like the trooper we called, who said without alarm to the handsome noble dog, "Where is he, buddy? Where is he, buddy?" At which, as if in a game of fetch, the dog went straight around the house to the one smell that didn't fit to the one smell that crossed the clipped grass into the ditch beside the dirt road where the dog went to. The dog tracking the smell, the trooper tracking the dog not barking or baying until the scent stopped inside the culvert bearing the brook west under the road, a large metal pipe that amplified the dog's whimpers and moans. Dog of righteousness, dog of retribution. We heard it from our house where soon the shutters would go up. We sat in the kitchen, the summer air soft as a damp rag. We knew this was a moment of consequence, but we couldn't tell whether the world had grown larger or smaller. Fox. Rangy, loping, swiveling left and right. I'm thinking nonchalant, but the doves flutter up to the roof of the barn. The crickets leap from the grass like fleas. A fox is in my yard, oh, my yard, oh. Plenty of songs in my head to sing to my child's child if she were here. She wakes in her wooden crib and sings to herself. Odd, happy child, so like another child, content in her pen with a pot, a metal straw, a lid, a hole in the lid, a glass hat, for the hole, a metal basket with smaller holes, one hole the size of the straw, for hours. I made the pieces fit, then took them apart, then made them fit. When I got tired, I lay me down, my little head against the flannel chicks and ducks, then slept, then woke, then took the puzzle up. My mother had another child sick unto death. She needed me to fall in love with solitude. I fell in love. It is my toy, my happiness. The child of my friends is never, ever left alone, asleep, awake, pushing her wooden blocks around the rug. They cannot bear her least distress. Their eyes stay on their sparrow, poor happy child. Last year, I startled a fox crossing the road, the tail more rust than red, the head cranked forward facing me. It stopped stock still, as if deciding whether to hurry forward or turn back. It had a yellow apple in its mouth, and the little ones chew on the bones. Oh, I need Kent to come up here and sing that. I could just maybe point to him and have him sing from the audience. Well, since my mother has been mentioned and brought into the room, this is a poem amid the other creatures. That's called My Mother. My mother, my mother, my mother, she could do anything, so she did everything. The world was an unplowed field, a dress to be hemmed, a scraped knee. It needed a casserole. It needed another alto in the choir. Her motto was apply yourself. The secret of life was spreading your gifts. Why hide your light under a bushel? You might forget it there in the dark times, the lonely times. The sun gone down on her resolve. She slept a little first so she'd be fresh. She put on a little lipstick, drawing on her smile. She pulled that hair up off her face. She pulled her stockings on. She stepped into her pumps. She took up her matching purse, already packed with everything they all would learn. They would be nice. They would apologize. They would be grateful whenever they had forgotten what to pack. She never did. She had a spare. She kissed your cheek. She wiped the mark away with her own spit. She marched you out again, unless you were that awful sort of stubborn, broody child who more and more I was, who once had been so sweet, so mild, staying put where she put me. What happened must have been the bushel I was hiding in. The sun gone down on her resolve. She slept a little first so she'd be fresh. She pulled her stockings on. She'd packed the words for my every lack. She had a little lipstick on her teeth. The mark on my cheek would not rub off. She gave the fluids from her mouth to it. She gave the tissues in her ample purse to it. I never did apologize. I let my sister succor those in need and suffer the little children. My mother knew we are self-canceling. She gave herself a lifetime C, an average grade. From then on out, she kept the lights on day and night. A garden needs the light. The sun could not be counted on. She slept a little day and night. She didn't need her stockings or her purse. She watered, she weeded, she fertilized. She stood in front, the tallest stalk, keeping the deer, the birds, all the world's idle, shameless thieves away. Geese. There is no cure for temperament. It's how we recognize ourselves, but sometimes within it, a narrowing imprisons or is opened, such as when my mother, in her last illness, snarled and spat, and how this lifted my dour father into a patient tenderness, thereby astounding everyone. But mostly it hardens who we always were. If you've been, let's say, a glass half empty kind of girl, you wait to the chorus of geese overhead, forlorn, for something has softened their nasal voices, their ugly aggression on the ground, they're worse than chickens, but flying, one leader falling back, another moving up to pierce the wind. No one in charge, or everyone in charge, in flight, each limited goose adjusts its part in the cluster just under the clouds. Do they mean together to duplicate the cloud, like the pelicans on the pond rearranging their shadows to fool the fish, another collective that constantly recalibrates? But fish don't need to reinvent themselves the way geese do when they negotiate the sky. On the fixed, unyielding ground, there is no end to hierarchy. The flock, the pack, the family, you know it's true. If you're a take charge kind of girl, I recommend houseplants in the windows facing south. The cacti, the cyclamen are blooming on the brink of winter. All it took was a little enforced deprivation, a little premature and structured dark. Bear. Pressed full length against the screen, unzipping it for a better grip to help him help himself to the seed and the suet, slung high under the eave by the man who has charged down from the bedroom onto the porch in his white loincloth like David against Goliath, but only one good lung shouting, swearing, and behind him the woman caught at the lip of the lit kitchen. Where was my sister with her gun? Or would she be praying, since she prays routinely for a parking spot and there it is? Or would she be speechless for once that this man, so moderate, so genial, so unlike me, had put himself one body length away from a full-grown bear? Or would she be saying, you, my dear, are the person who married him? Which, of course, I did, and I stood behind him as he stood his ground on the ground that is our porch. You can see the marks gouged by the famous claws on the wall inside new screen, now laced by a wire trellis on which nothing climbs, a vertical electric fence. One of us thinks the bear can hear it hum from the edge of the woods, watching us like a child sent to his room as we grill the salmon we spiked with juniper berries. The other one thinks the plural pronoun is a dangerous fiction, the source of so much unexpected loneliness. This one's called Sleep. Another heavy frost, what doesn't die or fly away? The groundhog, for instance, the bear, is deep in sleep. I'm thinking a lot about sleep. Translation, I'm not sleeping much. Who used to be a champion of sleep? Ex-champions are pathetic, my inner parent says. The world is full of evil, death, cruelty, degradation. Not sleeping scores only 2 out of 10. But a moral sense is exhausting. I am exhausted. A coma looks good to me. If only I could be sure there'd still be dreams. It's what I miss the most. Even in terrible dreams, at least you feel what you feel, not what you're supposed to feel. Your house burns down. So what if you survive? You rake the ashes sobbing, exhausted from trying to not smoke. I once asked for a simple errand from my beloved who wanted me not to smoke. He forgot, unforgivable. I fled the house like an animal, wounded, enraged. I was thinking more clearly than I had ever thought. My thought was, why prolong this life? I flung myself into the car. I drove like a fiend to the nearest store. I ask unthinking for unfiltered Luckies. Oh, brand of my girlhood. I paid the price. I took my prize to the car. I slit the cellophane. I tapped out one perfect white cylinder. I brought to my face the smell of the barns, the fires cooking at golden brown, smell of my father, my uncle's, my grandfather's tin of loose tobacco, his packet of delicate paper, the deliberate way he rolled and licked and tapped and lit and drew in and relished it, the smell of the wild girls behind the gym, the boys in pickup trucks. I sat in my car as the other cars crept by. I looked like a pervert. It was perverse, a Lucky under my nose. I drove myself home. I threw away the pack, which was unwise. The gods don't notice whining. They notice the brief, bright flares of human will. They lean from their couches. Yes, more fear and dread for that one. Yes, let's turn the suffering up a notch. Let's watch her strike the match. I strike it now when I wake in the dark. I light that little fire. Don't try that at home, children. It's very bad for you. This is called Owl. The sign for making the most of what you have on the human hand is a thumb at full right angle to the palm. For the owl, it's two talons forward, two back, a flexible foot that crushes the prey and lifts it to the beak, to the eyes, which are legally blind. This is why the owl hunts in the dark, in the dusk, when nothing is clearly seen. And why the owl's eyes are fixed, facing ahead to better focus. So its whole face swivels in each direction like the turret on a tank. The round plates of feathers surrounding the eyes collect the least sound. When it turns, the owl is computing by geometry the exact location of the mouse or snake or songbird that moves imperceptibly in its nest toward which the owl sets out from the hole in the tree, the bearer of the eave of the barn, and crosses the field in utter silence, wing feathers overlapped, to make no sound. Poor mouse, poor rabbit. Last night, from the porch obligato to the brook and the snuffling deer, intent on the gnarled, worm-bitten apples we leave on the tree, I heard what must have been a barred owl or a barn owl or a lesser horned owl close by, not deep in the woods. What I heard was less a call than a cry, a fragment repeating a kind of shudder, which may be why the country people I come from thought an owl was prescient, ill omen meant to unspool the threads they'd gathered and wound. I was a grown woman when my father took the key from under the eave and unlocked the door to the darkened house he had grown up in and stepped across the threshold and said as he entered the empty room, "Hello, Miss Sally," as though his stepmother, dead for weeks, were still in her usual chair. In the medicine wheel, the emblem for wisdom is the same for gratitude. At dusk, at dark, the far-sighted owl strikes in utter silence. When we hear it from the tree or the barn, what it announces is already finished. And I'll end with one that I want to read for Charles. It's such a great pleasure to read with you and to hear your work. So I'll read Larch by Charles. Short sleeves in Vermont, late November, the leaves long gone. Only evergreens, the white birch bark and a feral black cat. Not sheltering, prowling improbably in her thickened coat. One more free-range lunch, one more of her nine lives put back into reserve, unlike the year's fresh deaths. As for me, I keep my votive candles burning as the larches burned on the hillside, their needles yellow, deciduous like the leaves, and now sloughed in the yard beneath the small larch, bent double, cascading like a willow. Weeping is the proper name for it. Also for the cherry tree in the yard of the house where my parents' friend shot an intruder. It was his wife. Their tree might as well be here with all my other lost trees, childhood mimosas, magnolias, the willow oak blown down in a storm, surviving in my head beside the friend, the murdered wife, the subsequent wife, my parents too, and now Peter with his lazy eye and glamorous doom-ridden Wren, and Carol who had her own reprieves, who used them up. I confess the weather matters more and more to me. Diurnal is a lovely word. Another is circadian. Thanks for coming to listen.
Well, thank you, Ellen, for that exquisite reading, and Claudia for that very moving introduction. I look around a room like this, and I am, you know, very proud and humbled to be in this literary community. Thanks especially to Mary and Greg, who helped to make this happen, and the Library of Virginia. I'm making all these thank yous in part because I am deeply intimidated right now. How do you introduce one of the finest poets in the language, who has won every major award available to an American poet? The Pulitzer and the National Book Award, the Wallace Stevens Prize, the Ruth Lilly Prize, and the list goes on. How do you do such a poet justice? I have to start with an anecdote. The first book review I ever published in the University of Minnesota student newspaper was a review of this book, Charles Wright's third collection, Bloodlines, published way back in 1975. This was a book that, because of two amazing long sequences it contained, Skins and Tattoos, really made me feel like it had changed my life. And I remember having an argument with the editor of the paper because I said that with Bloodlines, Charles Wright had become one of our very best poets. He argued that I should instead say one of our most promising poets. And I replied very passionately that the word had to be the best because Bloodlines changed my life. So he agreed to keep my wording, and then the review came out and he didn't live up to his promise and put back most promising. Well, in the 38 years since that event, Charles Wright has proven time and time again over the course of over 20 books that he is among the best we have. And every time I read one of his poems, he continues to subtly and surprisingly change my life. He does this because he has an infallible ear and is capable of the most gorgeous lyric music. He does this because he is a spiritual seeker who contains all the multitudinous of Whitman, even when he is writing about his backyard in Charlottesville. He does this because he's found a way to mix the traditions of Pound, Hopkins, Lao Tzu, the Carter family, Paul Cezanne, and a host of others. And he does this because he is at home in Rome, Florence, Montana, Bristol, Virginia, and Kingsport, Tennessee, not to mention that backyard in Charlottesville, a place that seems not just to contain the whole planet, but the whole of the universe. And always, always, the goal of his project is to praise. And no poet alive praises with quite the ardor, humor, and astonishing invention as Charles Wright. It's a great honor to bring him to the stage tonight.
No way I can follow that. I mean, you know that. David, thank you very much. I remember that review very well, very well. It's a great review. This will not live up to what David says, but I'll try my best. Can you hear me back there? Because I don't, yeah, okay. This is called Appalachian Farewell. Sunset in Appalachia. Bituminous bulwark against the western sky drop, an advent of gold and green, an Easter of ashes. If night is our last address, this is the place we moved from. Backs on fire, our futures hard-edged and sure to arrive. These are the towns our lives abandoned, wind in our faces. The idea of incident like a box beside us on the trailway's seat. And where were we headed for? The country of narrative, that dark territory which spells out our stories in sentences, which gives them an end and beginning. Goddess of bad roads and inclement weather, take down our names. Remember us in the drip and thaw of the wintry mix. Remember us when the light cools. Help us never to get above our raising. Help us to hold hard to what was there. Orbank and Reedy Creek, Sir Gowansville down the line. This is called Bedtime Story. It's up in Montana, which is why the generator's there, because there's no electricity otherwise. The generator hums like a distant Dongan Zeke. It's early evening, and time, like the dog it is hungry for food. And we'll be fed, don't doubt it. We'll be fed, my small one. The forest begins to gather its silences in. The meadow regroups and hunkers down for its cleft feet. Something is wringing the rag of sunlight inexorably out and hanging. Something is making the reeds bend and cover their heads. Something is licking the shadows up and stringing the blank spaces along, filling them in. Something is inching its way into our hearts, scratching its blue nails against the wall there. Should we let it in? Should we greet it as it deserves, hands on our ears, mouths open? Or should we bring it a chair to sit on and offer it meat? Should we hum? Should we turn on the radio? Should we clap our hands and dance the something dance, the welcoming something dance? I think we should, love. I think we should. Appalachia on my mind. This is called Appalachia Dog. I can see it still, chopped in channel, dual pipes, metallic red, Appalachia Dog in black script on the left front door. A major ride, dragging the gut in Kingsport in 1952. A Ford, low life and low down. Up and back, then left at J. Fred's and west out of town into legend and legend's under half. It's twisted telling. The rear end was dropped as though the trunk was leaded for hauling. Shine hauling, we said, pretending to know something about something we knew nothing about. Zeke Cleek and the Moose Lodge boys, Junior Johnson's gray ghost, Mercury over in North Carolina, the dog flickering in the downtown lights like a candle flame. We never saw it again. And over the years, when those days are lifted out from their dark drawers, the peg pants with their welt seams, the Mr. B collars, the Les Paul and Mary Ford 78s broken in half, that 49 Ford is still there, taillight like nobody's eyes, low riding west toward the rising sun. I can't remember when I came up here. I may read forever. I wasn't even going to read this, but what the hell, I'm reading fast. Time will tell. Time was when time was not, in the world an uncut lawn ready for sizing. We looked and took the job in hand. Birds burst from my fingers, cities appeared, and small towns in the interim. We loved them all. In distant countries, tides nibbled our 2 feet on pebbly shores with their soft teeth and languorous tongues. Words formed and flew from our fingers. We listened and loved them all. Now finitude looms like antimatter, not this and not that, and everywhere like a present one bumps into, obvious, oblivious, unwittingly. Excuse me. I beg your pardon, but time has no pardon to beg and no excuses. The wind in the meadow grasses, the wind through the rocks, bends and breaks whatever it touches. It's never the same wind in the same spot, but it's still the wind and blows in its one direction, northwest to southeast, an ointment upon the skin, a little saliva. Time with its murderous gums and pale, windowless throat, its mouth pressed to our mouths, pushing the breath in, pulling it out. These next few poems are 6-line poems, and they're under the rubric of sestets. I fell into that on my way to trying to write 3-line poems, which is what should be the object of all poets, because if you can't say it in 3 lines, get out. I can't do it. I got a couple with it, I mean, good. And I don't mean haiku, I mean American poems. This is called Future Tense. All things in the end are bittersweet. An empty gaze, a little way station just beyond silence. If you can't delight in the everyday, you have no future here. If you can, no future either. And time, black dog, will sniff you out and lick your lean cheeks and lie down beside you, warm, real close, and will not move. I'm not really obsessed by time, it was just those two in a row. Actually, I am obsessed by time. We all are. It's basically all there is, you know? And it doesn't even exist. From Appalachia we go to the Mississippi River. This poem is called With Horace, the Latin poet. Sitting on the platform, waiting for the Robert E. Lee. Horace lived out in the country outside Rome and had a farm. You know, wrote all those country poems. 70 years and what's left? Or better still, what's gone before? A couple of lines, a day or two out in the cold, and all those books. Those half-baked books, sweet yeast for the yellow dust. What say, Orazio? Like you, I'm sane and live at the edge of things. Countryside flooded with light, sundown, the chaos of future mornings just over the ridge, but not here yet. looked at it before. I saw the movie Gladiator, where the guy says, "Not yet, not yet." And I thought, "You stole my line." This is called Yellow Wings. When the sun goes down and you happen to notice it, the sky's clear. And the sky's clear, there's always a whitish light etching the earth's offerings. This is the lost impermanent light the soul is pulled toward and longs for deep in its cave, little canary. This is the light its wings dissolve in if it ever gets out from underground. The ghost of Walter Benjamin, or Benjamin, walks at midnight. The world's an untranslatable language without words or parts of speech. It's language of objects our tongues can't master, but which we are the ardent subjects of. If tree is tree in English, and albero in Italian, that's as close as we can come to divinity, the language that circles the earth in which we'll never speak. When the horses gallop away from us, it's a good thing. I always find it strange, though I shouldn't, how creatures don't care for us the way we care for them. Horses, for instance, and chipmunks, and any bird you'd name. Empathy's only a one-way street. And that's all right, I've come to believe. It sets us up for ultimate things, and penultimate ones as well. It's a good lesson to have in your pocket when the call comes to call. I swore on my ancestors' graves when I was in graduate school that I would never use the word penultimate in a poem. So sue me. I don't know what happened. I still don't think it's a good idea. They love that word in graduate school. Like the new moon, my mother drifts through the night sky. Beyond the boundaries of light and dark, my mother's gone out and not come back. Suddenly now, in my backyard, like the slip moon, she rises and rests in my watching eye. In my dreams, she's returned just like this over 100 times. She knows what I'm looking for, partially her, and partially what she comes back not to tell me. I'll read till the cows come home. That's it. I think they're already home, though, actually. Sentences two, which presupposes a sentence is one, somewhere back there when I swore not to use penultimate. Sentences two, last chapter, last verse. Everything's brown now in the golden field. The threshing floor of the past is past. The overmountain men of the future lie cusped in their little boxes. The sun backs down over the ridgeline at 7:05. The landscape puts on its black mass and settles into its sleeplessness. The fish will transpose it, half for themselves, half for the water 10,000 miles away at the end of the darkening stream. To live a pure life, to live a true life, is to live the life of an insect. This one's called Heaven's Zeal, which is sort of a prayer, but it's sort of like me, it's been transformed into something unrecognizable. Heaven's Zeal, a slight wrinkle on the pond, small wind. A small wind in the rumpled cloud's reflection. Oh, hum. What's needed is something under the pond's skin, something we can't see that controls all the things that we do see, something long and slithery, something we can't begin to comprehend. A future we're all engendered for. Sharp teeth, Lord, such sharp teeth. Heaven's eel. Heaven's eel, long and slick. Full moon gone with nothing in its place. A doe is nibbling away at the long stalks of the natural world across the creek. It's good to be here. It's good to be where the world's quiescent and reminiscent. No wind blows from the far sky. Beware of prosperity, friend, and seek affection. The eel's world is not your world, but will be soon enough. Shadow and smoke. The first line is something I read or heard. It was said by Che Guevara. But then, now I think it's probably some Zen koan from about 4,000 years ago. But I don't know. Che probably picked it up. He wouldn't know. Live your life as though you were already dead, Che Guevara declared. Okay, let's see how that works. Not much different as far as I can see. The earth, the same paradise it's always wanted to be. Heaven as far away as before. The clouds, the same old movable gates since time began. There is no circle. There is no sentiment to be broken. There are only the songs of young men and the songs of old men hoping for something elsewise. Disabuse them in their ignorance, Lord. Tell them the shadows are already gone, the smoke already cleared. Tell them that light is never a metaphor. This is called Grace 2.
Same as Synthesis 2.
It's true, the aspirations of youth burn down to char strips with the years. Tonight, only memories are my company and my grace. How nice if they could outlive us, but they can't or won't. No Indian summer for us. It's rough and it's growing dark. The sunset pulling the full moon up by its long fingernails. It's better this way. The unforgiven are pure, as are the unremembered. This is called Road Warriors. My traveling clothes light up the noon. I've been on my way for a long time back to the past, the irreconcilable city. Everyone wants to join me, it seems, and I let them. Roadside flowers drive us to distraction. Dragonflies hover like lapis lazuli, there, just out of reach. Narrow road, wide road, all of us on it, unhappy, unsettled, 7 yards short of immortality and 1 yard short of not long to live. Better to sit down in the tall grass and watch the clouds, to lift our faces up to the sky, considering for most of us, our lives have been one constant mistake. This is called, in the last one, the October No No More. The first leaves lie like sea urchins browned on the asphalt drive. It's got to be October, slayer of living things, refrigerator of memory. Next to the wilted lettuce, next to the Simone Bay, our lives are shoved in, barely visible, but still unspoiled. Our history is the history of the city of God. What's to come is anybody's guess. Whatever has given you comfort, whatever has rested you, whatever untwisted your heart, is what you will leave behind. And one more, just a closer walk with thee. Just a closer walk with thee. But not too close, man. Just not too close. Between the divine and the divine lies a lavish shadow. Do we avoid it or stand in it? Do we gather the darkness around us or do we let it slide by? better to take it into our hearts, better to let us have it, better to let us be what we should be. Tonight, the sexual energy of the evergreens removes us from any such attitude, at least for a momentary intake, and then it's back in its natural self, between the it and the it, the fly that won't leave the corpse will end up in the grave. This is her critter form for Ellen. It's called Duck. It's also up in Montana where the damn generator seems to go all the time. Gasoline smell on my hands, perfume from the generator's toothless mouth, opening swallow from the green hose, sweet odor from the actual world. There's an old Buddhist saying I think I read one time, before enlightenment, chop wood and carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood and carry water. The ducks, who neither carry nor chop, understand this as I never will. Their little feet propelling them under the water, serene and stabilized from the far side of the pond back to the marsh grasses and cattails. I watch them every night they're here. Serenitas, I watch them. Acceptance of what supports you, acceptance of what's above your body, invisible carrion chop, dark understory of desire, where we should live, not in the thrashing, dust-tipped branches. Desire is anonymous, motoring hard, unswayable in the unsealed. This last one's called Lullaby. I've said what I had to say as melodiously as it was given to me. I've said what I had to say as far down as I could go. I've been everywhere I've wanted to, but Jerusalem, which doesn't exist. So I guess it's time to depart, time to go, time to meet those you've never met, time to say good night. Grant us silence, grant us no reply, grant us shadows and their cohorts still across the sky. Thank you all very much. Again.
Well, if you hear better poems than that anytime soon, between Ellen and Charles, I don't want to know about it. Thank you all very much for coming. There are books for sale. I'm sure the poets would be willing to sign one or two if you spend the money. And thank you very much. And thank you, Ellen and Charles, for wonderful poetry.